It's MRCTV's public service announcement with Brittany Hughes and Eric Shiner.
Welcome to the MRCTV podcast. I'm Eric Shiner. We just have a few more weeks with Brittany Hughes out on maternity leave, but joining me today to talk about the media and their relative thin skin when things are done to them that they like to do to others is Tim Graham from Newsbusters. Tim, thanks for being with us.
No problem.
So, Tim, a lot of people look at Twitter, and a lot of journalists in the past find things that conservatives say, that Republicans say, and they'll go back to like 2008 on Twitter and dig up tweets and say, this is horrible, this person said this, they are mean, they're nasty, they should be canceled. Basically, this cancel culture that the Democrats have. Now, well, Republicans and conservatives are doing it to them, and they don't like it very much.
Yeah, the most recent example being a journalist from the New York Times who had said some rather obnoxious, racist-sounding things or anti-Semitic-sounding things in his youth. Because he's 32 now, and I guess they're 10-year-old tweets. But, yeah, it's not just politicians that the media have done this to. Athletes, as a Milwaukee Brewers fan, Josh Hader, the relief pitcher, they dug out tweets he made when he was like 17. So it is humorous that the New York Times does a story where they're like, the Trump people are going to try to disparage legitimate news reporting by revealing old tweets.
And they don't like it. They complain about it. And I mean, their whole article is basically, this is a horrible, awful thing, but it was fine when they did it.
Once again, they always see everything through the prism of, we are the forces of democracy. Trump is against democracy. So anything Trump and his supporters do is somehow anti-democracy, anti-free press, anti-legitimate reporting. That's what they call what they do. And this is where people at the New York Times don't understand. This is why we don't like you. Because you're so arrogant that they think only you represent democracy, only you represent journalism, please.
And of course, this week they had Brett Stevens, who decided that he didn't want to be called a bedbug. And it was, that story's kind of funny. The more you follow it, I mean, the tweet that called him that initially had like nine people saw it. I mean, it really didn't go very far, but he made a bigger deal out of it.
Yeah, complaining to, I guess it was a George Washington University professor was one of these that tweeted this.
Right.
And then it became a hashtag of Brett Bug.
and this all stems from the fact that the New York Times has bed bugs. It's infested with bed bugs, which is somehow not surprising.
It happens in large cities, you know, not rat infested yet.
Oh, now you're going to go down another hole.
But it's, you know, Brett Stevens is one of these people who would like to say, we need a civil discourse.
Yeah, I'm going to be careful with my words because okay. I know these are going to be examined carefully. So I think Twitter brings out the worst in its users. It tends to bring out the worst in its users. And yesterday, a professor at George Washington University described me as a bedbug or a metaphorical bedbug, just in the context of the New York Times having a bedbug problem in our building. And I think that kind of rhetoric is dehumanizing and totally unacceptable, no matter where it comes from.
Well, we went out back yesterday digging through our own archives at Newsbusters and saying, well, here's what Brett Stevens wrote about Ted Cruz. He's a serpent who would sell his own family into slavery. Okay, so bedbug.
So don't compare someone to a bug, but compare them to a snake. That's somehow that's somehow better?
Yeah, exactly. And he's done a lot of this where he's compared Trump to Hugo Chavez, Juan Perón, Maduro in Venezuela, and of course the usual Putins and other dictators. So this is the problem, it's represented by this, and that is they're basically saying we are allowed to call you Hitler, Stalin, Mao, etc., but bedbug, that's beyond the pale.
All I would say is that using dehumanizing rhetoric like bedbugs or, you know, analogizing people to insects is always wrong. We can do better. We should be the people on social media that we are in real life.
I guess I look at it this way. It's a good thing to me that people on the conservative and on the Republican side are fighting back since they get their Twitter feeds dug up and anything they remotely said when they were younger is brought up and put up. And look, he said this. I mean, poor Kevin Hart, the comedian, not that I would actually consider him necessarily a conservative, but he put out tweets years ago. And of course, that cost him his job at, you know, hosting the Emmys. But now it's happening back to them. There's kind of this scorched earth thing with this cancel culture where nobody, you know, you have to go after somebody's job and they should be removed and they're awful and evil because of a tweet that they made. Who knows if it was in haste? Who knows? I mean, you know, some of these tweets are coming out with when kids were 16 or 17 mm-hmm, years old. Mm-hmm. I don't expect a 16 or 17 year old to be culturally sensitive.
Yeah. Well, it's. I think there should be that sort of charity granted, but there's part of that, again, is the whole notion of, you know, I was tweeting to 9 of my friends in high school. If that's their standard, if that's the New York Times standard, they really, the media should have applied that to a Josh Hader. They should have applied it to athletes and entertainers to say, these were the early days of Twitter. How many followers people actually saw that? I mean, look, this is the problem with journalism in general, is journalism now often centers on hot social media posts. I mean, the other day, there's the Amazon fires, and how does the NBC report it? And now Leo DiCaprio's Instagram. I mean, that's because that's how they're relating to the audience.
That's right. Yeah, that's the issue that has weight. That's the fact that has weight.
They scientists, nobody needs that. But I mean, so yeah, and obviously the president, everything the president tweets is news, and then it'll be Trump tweeted this, somebody else tweeted this back, Ilhan Omar has a hot tweet, and it suffices now, instead of a press conference, it's a tweet storm. So, I mean, everybody who's on Twitter knows that when you push the submit button, you're taking a risk. So I don't think, I mean, these people at the New York Times didn't lose their job. It's just embarrassing.
No, but some of the things that were dug up on them were actually pretty heavy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, and the one that which was even worse was this Mohammed El-Shami at CNN who was tweeting about Zionist pigs.
Yeah, he was happy that the Jewish pigs killed in Jerusalem, today by the Palestinian bomb that exploded, basically. That was in 2011. More than 4 Jewish pigs killed in Jerusalem.
Yeah, that to me sounds like something that somebody you don't want to keep on your staff, but they did. And that's, again, that is the kind of thing that everybody, you would like Twitter to be a slightly saner place where you don't wish people dead. And I think that's a challenge for journalists. The whole problem with journalism right now is it rewards hot takes. So, yes, people who would be considered objective reporters say very not objective things on Twitter.
But this is,
and create an underlying media bias.
But this is a pretty consistent thing we've seen in the news lately, where the journalists in the news organizations for the mainstream media say, well, it's good for you, but it's not good for me. Let's take April Ryan's case, for instance, where she had her security guard throw out a reporter and a camera while she was speaking at a neighborhood event. You know, and here is, you know, she represents CNN, the beacon of free speech, and the Trump administration is going to trample the freedom of the press. And they're the beacon. But yet the reporters, she said something bizarre. She said something like, I don't have
press at my events.
Yeah, I don't have cameras at my events.
And that was a surprise because he said, we were invited. Our cameras were invited. And then she tried to pawn it all off on the security guard. Oh, it was his idea.
Yeah, that was unreliable sources, wasn't it? She appeared with Stelter, who sat there and let her get away with saying, well, you know, my security guard did it. And I, according to my contract that I had, you know, he had the approval of the organization, but he didn't have my approval.
If someone asked for permission, I would have granted it. But sometimes your words are twisted by people who don't necessarily understand you or what you're saying or who have an agenda. And that kind of thing can charge the atmosphere to create hate against me.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where you need to you can't run around lecturing about freedom of the press if you're not willing to submit to that sort of scrutiny, especially in a public event. This is a public event. It's one thing if you're saying, I, April Ryan, am speaking at some private meeting of the Congressional Black Caucus. I don't want any cameras there. I mean, obviously, political groups meet without cameras.
Right, but those
but
are designated
don't invite
private
cameras.
Meetings.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. No, those are designated no press events. And then you have people like Acosta who writes his book there, Enemy of the People, and how he's worried that, you know, Trump supporters are going to hurt him and come after him. And of course, who's the first reporter that we see attacked? Oh, it's Andy Ngo.
Yeah.
By Antifa. It's not CNN.
And that's one of the worst things, honestly, is this, to me, it underlines how the liberal media will put Antifa before their own prerogatives. It's fascinating to me that when NBC's camera crew is assaulted by Antifa, NBC didn't report it. That's just, to me, is mind-boggling. And so, yeah, I kind of expected that Andy Ngo being beaten in Portland was going to be a Fox story. And that's kind of what happens, is we're so tribal, is that they'll all say, well, that's a Fox story. He's a Fox guy. We're not, and they end up spiking stories they really should be doing. Because if they really care about people having access to public events, I mean, that's, I don't think you should bring a camera to an Antifa / Proud Boys event, because they're both doing it for the cameras and they both want to get violent. One of the reasons Charlottesville was such a mess is because the Washington Post and other media freaked out that people were coming to Charlottesville. And you know what happens? You get like 50 or 100 nutball neo-Nazis.
You get a mob mentality going.
And then there's 1,000 liberals show up. And then, of course, the aforementioned very fine people come who aren't Nazis, but don't want the Confederate statues to come down. And then you have that whole mess of people constantly saying Trump said they were very fine neo-Nazis, which is not what he said.
No, that's not what he said at all. In fact, he exempted them. He actually said, yeah, you had those Nazi groups there, but other than that, there were some very fine people on both sides.
And
but
still,
everyone cuts out the earlier, where he takes out the Nazis and the white supremacist part.
I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch. Those people were also there because they wanted to protest the taking down of a statue, Robert E. Lee.
I mean, it's just sad that we've had Chris Cuomo defending Antifa. We had Chuck Todd putting Antifa to explain themselves and their tactics. And so to me, they are not people who are against extremism, and especially violent extremism. If you're
well, Fredo wants to throw people down the stairs.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
It's kind of hard to say he's all for peace, love, and flowers. I mean,
yeah, there you go.
Call him a name, he gets pretty upset.
Well, and that's what was the weird thing, is the Washington Post does the story, and it's like CNN's is worried about a climate of violence. It's like, well, wait a minute. Yeah, April Ryan's having her security guard throwing a guy out. Cuomo's threatening to throw a guy down the stairs, and somebody says Don Lemon's sexually assaulting them. I don't get why.
Yeah, they had a pretty bad week about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, when all this went down. They did not have a good week. As we mentioned earlier, when people dig through folks' Twitter, you actually get a better idea how much these so-called journalists are activists.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was recently mentioned on Newsbusters was the Tatiana Schlossberg.
Yeah.
Granddaughter of the Kennedy. They talk about her, and they're proud. They're proud. She's repeatedly referred to as a journalist, but they're proud about her new book that explores the role of climate change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now to the Kennedy family and their long history of public service.
In a moment, we're going to talk to JFK's granddaughter, Tatiana Schlossberg. She has authored a new book that explores the role we all play in climate change. She's the author of a brand new book, Inconspicuous Consumption, a call to action in the fight against climate change. The journalist has been covering the environment since graduating from Yale University. Your mm-hmm. family's been involved as public servants and members of this community and making a difference for so long. Did you feel sort of a responsibility to have a cause? And is the environment that cause for you?
Well, I'm a journalist.
This is the daughter of Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg, and she's a reporter. She's a writer for the New York Times. You know, she's like the latest generation of Maria Shriver, who was another branch of the Kennedy family, who was very beloved at NBC for years, and we always thought that was kind of preposterous. She was, you know, sort of the predecessor to the George Stephanopoulos and the Chris Cuomo. But here in this case, yeah, they brought her on NBC yesterday, and it was, oh, we're so proud of your journalism and your activism, and they're basically kind of the same thing. And we all understand this instinctively. When it comes to climate change, they've made it quite clear. Chuck Todd made it clear on NBC's Meet the Press. We don't acknowledge there are two sides.
Because that's the best way to have a debate. That's the way to have an intellectual discussion. We don't acknowledge.
Well, because even if you want to say there's no scientific debate, there still has to be a legislative policy debate. And they're basically saying, no, we really want to steamroller that too.
Right.
And you can't. And that's the whole problem they have. And that is that the news media, the big principle for me is always, they don't want to, they never want to debate about whether it's happening. And even people who are not climate panickers can say, well, you could see a warming trend here. But they don't want to have a debate about the Green New Deal. They didn't want to have a debate in the Clinton years about the things the House wanted to pass. The House passed a bill. The Senate wouldn't take it up, a lot like this, in a sense. They never want to get into the policy specifics. But we did have this funny thing the other day where Bernie, I guess, said that it was going to cost like $16 trillion, his Green New Deal.
Yeah, he kind of put a price tag on it of his own volition.
And Ali Velshi on MSNBC was like, well, there's also a cost of not doing something. I mean, the spin is so energetic. But that's the whole thing, is if somebody said to you or any homeowner, well, I can fix, I have this new climate change option for your house. That'll be $1.5 million. You would say, I don't think so. And that's part of the problem, is that everything that they want to impose is dramatically expensive. So what they really want is they want the issue of, we're on the moral high ground, and let's not actually talk about all the policy details, but you hate science.
The column that you co-wrote with Brent Boesel came out. They can dish it out and they can't take it. They're not on the moral high ground. It's the same as what we talk about with Twitter. They come out and they find, oh, this person said this evil thing. This politician's tweeted this out in 2008, 2011. But when it's done to them, they get very, very upset. They write a column how wrong it is over at the New York Times. My question is, now that the tides have been flipped on them and basically they're getting it back, does it escalate from here, in your opinion? Do they kind of back off a bit, saying, well, this isn't a good thing? Does it become like the Cold War, mutually assured destruction?
I would be a pessimist on that one. I think that going into the 2020 campaign season, they're going to assume that Team Trump's going to be at their 2016 level, I suppose. And this, to them, I think they feel this is a warning shot, that Arthur Schwartz and all these Trump people are going to be digging around in their Twitter closet. And so they're preparing look at the whole 1619 project the New York Times is doing. We are going to basically do a whole series of stories about just how deeply racist America is. To me, I would say that's mudslinging 101. It's one thing to say America has a history where we had slaves. America had a history of segregation. It's another thing to say, oh, by the way, right now, you people are all racists. That's a little bit different.
But that's what they do.
Yeah. And so I think the idea that the debate is going to be civil and kind and polite, I think we can kind of throw that out the window.
But things are going to get worse before they get better.
But the problem is, yes, what we all have to try to underline is the whole notion that this underlines, which is, you are not the white knights who are civil and kind and polite. You're the ones that put on guests who say Trump is worse than Stalin, Hitler, and Mao. How is that? Where are
You know? And then they get mad when President Trump doesn't answer a question, like with Jim Acosta recently. Again, this has happened over and over with Jim Acosta. Like, I didn't call on you. Don't interrupt. Well, in the moving end, on.
Most of the time, they're not questions. He's just yelling attacks. And especially at that point, when you're at the end of a newscast, most at the end of a press conference, most presidents are going to walk off at the end and ignore whatever people are shouting at the end. That's pretty standard. Should be especially standard for him. But yes, this is another thing you're going to hear, is that Trump is not giving enough access to people who want him destroyed. Now, if your channel is 24/7 impeach Trump or use the 25th Amendment to throw him out of office, why would you grant that network an interview? These people were not running around in the Obama year saying, you know, he really needs to do more Bill O'Reilly.
Well, I mean, Obama had that famous press conference where he was asked the question by a Daily Caller reporter during a press event before he was ready to take questions, which he didn't take at the end. Obama scolded him, and oh boy, the hue and the cry that went up in the liberal media about that.
Yep.
But then we have the same thing with Jim Acosta at a Trump event, and that's okay.
It's exactly the double standard again, which is it would be rude to question Obama in a hostile way. You can't ask him an impertinent question he doesn't want to ask to him. And I'm still amazed that all we got with Obama was, and now Brian Williams will go on a burger run with the president. I mean, and that, you know, and a lot of his press coverage was, Barack and Michelle go to Hamilton. Trump never gets any of this. I mean, there's no gushy covers about Melania Trump. We all understand that's not going to happen. The way Michelle is still getting the American goddess type coverage. And so let me just lay this down for you. The Barack and Michelle Obama buy this massive
waterfront property, $15 million, something like that.
Not a story. Look for the networks to cover that. And at the same time that they were fulminating about Trump suggesting they have the G7 at one of his properties next time. And Hallie Jackson asked a fair question, which is, how can you reassure us you're not using the presidency to enrich yourself? Okay, that's fair. But what's Obama doing? What has Obama done? And what did the Clintons do? The Clintons, made millions and millions and millions of dollars in between the quote-unquote presidencies. I mean, if she really wanted to be president, why on earth is he making $500,000 speeches in Moscow? That's the kind of collusion they were never interested in.
The press isn't going to ask that question. We are out of time. Tim Graham, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tim Graham from Newsbusters. Great to have you here. And you can be sure to catch up on all the previous podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. Search us out, MRC TV Podcast. Until next week, we'll see you then.